This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
Welcome and thank you for taking the time to listen to the program today. It's always a pleasure to be able to speak to you wherever you are around the globe. And of course, I hope that you have a good time and that you manage to get something done and stay relatively calm in what seems like a storm that is just picking up momentum. My name is Henrik and this is Red Ice Radio, the program dedicated to asking questions and digging deeper underneath the media headlines. There's much more for you to listen to, see, and read on our website, redicecreations.com. I hope you take some time to go over there and follow along in our news also. There are a number of ways that you can get the radio program, a few different ways to listen, whatever is convenient for you. All the info is on the website. Today we have Britt D. and Tom Secker with us on the program to talk about the Anders Behring Breivik case and trial. Britt D. is a writer, researcher, and broadcaster. His journalism is regularly published on many alternative media sites. Britt is particularly interested in global terrorism, real and contrived, the manipulations and subversive agendas of the political and financial elite, and the propaganda of the mainstream media. Tom Secker is a British-based writer, researcher, and filmmaker who specializes in terrorism, the security services, and declassified history. He has been writing on the philosophy and politics of fear since 2008. Britt and Tom will discuss the Anders Behring Breivik trial, points of interest in the case, interesting connections, suspicious aspects, and the strategy of tension. We'll talk about how this terrorist event may be used to further the globalists' agenda. Very important. Stay with us for much more. So let's say hi and welcome to Britt D. first here from resistradio.com. Thanks for coming on the program today, Britt.
You're welcome, Henrik. Thanks for having me on.
Excellent. Really good to have you. And then, of course, we have also Tom Secker on the other end of the line with us as well. Welcome, Tom. Thanks for joining us here today as well.
Hello, Henrik. Thanks for inviting us on.
You bet. You guys did a really good podcast about a month ago or so about the Anders Behring Breivik case, the Oslo bombings and the shootings at Utøya Island on July 22nd, 2011. And obviously the trial and everything is in full run here right now. There's a lot of new data coming out about the case as well. But in the beginning, I think we should run through, I guess, some of the basics, some of the background on why this case have been interesting and, you know, why this has been important to you guys. Maybe we can begin with you, Britt, and just there's a certain degree of proximity here. This is Northern Europe, not too far away from you guys in the UK over there. But what has stood out to you, Britt, about this case? Why is it of interest to you?
Yeah, I mean, I've had an interest in terrorism for a number of years, and particularly conspiracies related to terrorism. And so when I initially heard about this attack in Norway, I have to admit that maybe I was myself a victim of this constant brainwashing about Muslims that we've all experienced over the past decade or even more, because my initial reaction was that, you know, this is going to be blamed on a Muslim terrorist. This is going to be Al-Qaeda, just because this really was so unprecedented, this massive attack on European soil. So as soon as it became clear that this was a white guy and, you know, a white Norwegian guy, that's when I really became interested in it. And just the scale of the thing was just, you know, so horrific that, yeah, I couldn't help but take an interest in it and start researching it. I mean, it links into so many things with the bombing, and it's sort of echoes of Oklahoma City and things like this. And yeah, it was just, you know, it really piqued my interest, basically.
Very good. There's so many points that were highlighted in your podcast that I'd like to run through again here today. And then some of these have myself been interested in, try to, you know, answer some of the questions about this. It's a very puzzling case. I agree with you on that, Britt. How about you, Tom? What's been the main pull for you in this?
Well, it was sort of, initially, I think it was kind of a shock that of all the places that you wouldn't expect a mass scale terrorist attack to happen, I think, you know, Norway's right up there. It just doesn't have much of a history of this kind of thing. In fact, it has barely any history of terrorism whatsoever. And so I was kind of stunned by that. And then sort of watching the media coverage unfolding, what struck me, and we discussed this in our podcast, was that almost everyone was kind of leaping to the conclusion that they'd already made up their minds about. They were all sort of kind of exploiting this attack for an agenda that already existed in their minds. And one of these examples would be you had the Sun newspaper the day after the attack, blazed headline saying Norway's 9/11 and trying to blame this whole thing on Muslims. And, you know, obviously a few hours after they published that front page, it sort of became clear that this was actually, at least apparently, the work of a white Norwegian, you know, a sort of domestic terrorist. So obviously they had egg on their faces in that regard. But also, you know, everyone across the whole of the press, and I'm talking mainstream and alternative, I just saw how there were kind of so many different agendas being sort of tagged to this attack. And I wondered why that was, and, you know, whether there was sort of more to that story, or at least, you know, what the effects of that were going to be, and what the how that was going to develop and progress. And so that's why I've sort of stuck with the case for a while, and one of the reasons why me and Britt were talking about it.
You bet. It's been interesting to see also how this event has been used. I think, well, we're going to try to get into this and get a little closer to an answer of basically who is behind it. I mean, is it possible that he could have done all of this by himself? If not, did he have help? By who? Was he mind controlled? There's a number of questions that they're up there, high up on the list of intriguing questions to ask about this, and also consequently how the event has been used and by who, because undoubtedly at this point we can see the reaction in Norway and around the world that there is also a rallying now then obviously against these so-called, you know, very very extreme right-wing nationalists in Europe that are, you know, kind of lashing out here now in a sense. But Breivik had an interesting strategy. We're going to talk about this. You highlighted this in your article, Breivik's plan of increased polarization, Britt, as well, that we linked up in connection to the podcast that you guys did, with some very interesting data there. But is there any way we can pin this down for the sake of just making it simple? Is it, do we know too little at this point, Britt, to be able to, you know, say who he is, who is really behind it, or is this just this? We must have more data to be able to figure this out. What do you think?
In my opinion, I haven't been able to come to any firm conclusions simply because there isn't enough evidence there. But my feeling is that, you know, there are people behind Breivik. And what surprised me most about all of this is the fact that the police and the prosecutors have tried to make out that this network that he has said he's part of simply doesn't exist. And I don't know whether this is a part of their attempt to make him seem insane, but it strikes me as very odd because, as Tom and I talked about in the podcast that we did, you know, Breivik doesn't come across as a liar particularly, and he's been quite specific about this network that he's a part of, but the authorities have just said, no, we don't think it exists. And that's incredibly dangerous because if these people do exist, which we've no reason to believe they don't, because the evidence suggests that Breivik was in the places he said he was when he was, for example, you know, he says he was at this founding meeting of the Knights Templar in London in 2002. And there's actually evidence for that, a credit card receipt from a cafe. So, yeah, these other people quite likely exist. And, of course, we don't know who is above these other people. So he's talked about four people in London, and he's talked about another two people in Norway. But, of course, there could be, you know, a whole load of people above these other people mm-hmm. who maybe Breivik himself isn't even aware of, who could well be controlling this. And as me and Tom have talked about, you know, this very much plays into a strategy of tension. So that would certainly benefit whoever, if there is somebody manipulating all of this, it would certainly benefit, you know, their plan. And as Tom and I have also talked about, even if that's not the case, this is still going to be used by, you know, many different people to advance an agenda. So mm-hmm. even if there weren't members of the elite behind this, then they're certainly going to be using it to try and further their agenda, which is, you know, of course, one of increased power and, you know, cracking down on civil liberties and things like this.
You bet. Really good point. What's your take on this, Tom? Anything to add to that?
Not fundamentally. I don't think we do have enough data to sort of be certain quite what's happened here. I mean, it's not like with, say, 9/11, where we all watched it on television, we all watched it live on TV, and what we saw, we could tell, you know, something isn't adding up here. Something's, what they're saying and the images that we're seeing just don't connect properly. It's not like with that, where we sort of straight away, we had an awful lot of the data that we needed to then say, no, this official story, you know, fundamentally isn't true. There must be more to this. There must be someone else involved here. We don't really have so much of that with the Breivik case, because obviously we have a few sort of clips of CCTV and have helicopter footage from the news helicopter that got to the island when the shootings were happening. But we don't have the kind of fundamental physical evidence to be able to prove that there is something more, that there is a larger conspiracy. Well, a conspiracy, because, mm-hmm. you know, it would have to be a conspiracy if it was more than one man. But I do think that Britt's right, that either way, part of me says, you know, does it really matter that much? I mean, yes, it does. But at the same time, that agenda and that strategy of tension was probably going to happen regardless of when another major terrorist attack happened in Europe and regardless of, excuse me, who was responsible for it. There's lots of different possibilities. You know, they could have known about this ahead of time and just let it happen. They could have assisted Breivik in making it happen, or he could be, you know, 100% a complete patsy. He could be, you know, like you say, sort of mind controlled or in some way brainwashed or hypnotized. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he's now happy to take responsibility for all of this, even if he didn't actually do it. You know, all of these things are possible, but I don't think at this point we have the kind of smoking gun evidence that would enable us to separate those possibilities and say this one is the most likely and this one's the less likely.
Well, that's a really good point. I think, well, one thing that has been interesting for me anyway was watching him live during the, you know, the video feed through the Norwegian media here during the trial. It because he seems very, well, focused, for the lack of a better word. He's really intent on, I think he's still carrying on his mission. It's only begun. And I think he actually expressed this idea himself that, you know, his action, the event here, the bombing and the shooting is like just step one. I mean, right now he considers himself, I guess, to be a writer, to try to release and continue this war or whatever we want to call it, you know, from prison. And one of the first things that they try to do as well in Norway is to try to, I guess, declare him insane, which was kind of interesting because they wanted to try to obviously keep him behind bars for a longer period of time than the maximum punishment does in Norway, which is, I forget what it is now, 20 years, 22?
21 years, I think, yeah.
There you go. Yep. So that's interesting to see how this has, you know, played out as well. And the more I've been watching him, the more uncertain, I guess, I've been as well about, you know, is he genuinely, you know, did he do all this himself? He might actually have been able to pull that off, which is an incredible feat in that sense, but and horrific, obviously. We have to mention that we're kind of forced to look at it a little bit with cold eyes in order to kind of analyze this horrible situation. But what I liked about what you guys did was that it was a non-sensationalistic approach to it, rather. It was you know, more try to look at what we have. And one of the reasons for this, I'm going to get both of you guys' take on this, is because, you know, there's a little bit of a different climate in Norway and Scandinavia overall. The lid goes on first, and there is a slow release of the information progressively, like through now this trial. And this is, you know, we're almost a year later here now, and there's still new and a lot of information coming out. In some of the other countries, US, maybe England as well, you have a different approach by the journalists and the papers there. Even if it's mainstream, you still have people really pushing for, you know, the scoop information about this kind of stuff. But here is a little bit of a different climate. The media is very, very, very controlled in the sense that they rely on what the police say and when they say it. So hence, that might have led to some level of speculation, simply because we didn't know and have information, you know, right at the outset. So people jump to conclusions. But there are certainly some of these bits we want to run through and talk about. But any comments on that, Tom or Britt?
I mean, I've actually been surprised by the lack of sort of alternative analysis of this case, to be honest. I mean, I know both Tom and myself went to your interview that you did with Professor Peter Dale Scott. And apart from that, and maybe a few articles on InfoWars, for example, I haven't seen a great deal of alternative analysis. But yeah, I can certainly take your point that the media in Norway works differently, and that's, you know, that's why there hasn't been so much information released. I mean, the Norwegian people do seem to be, I don't know, quite reserved, and we've seen that during the trial, really.
Yeah.
And I mean, this was also, I read an interesting article just the other day, actually, about the people who actually tried to attack Breivik on the island. There were apparently no actual Norwegians who did that. It was a couple of guys from Chechnya who tried to tackle him. Hmm. And this article was speculating, you know, possibly this was because of the Norwegian culture of kind of relying on the authorities and, you know, thinking the authorities are going to take care of everything.
So, oh, you bet. Good point. Yeah.
Certainly an issue here with the Norwegian culture. And
I mean, it's incredible when you think about it that a guy like this managed to roam around and shoot so many people before it happened. I mean, he gave himself up voluntarily, like, okay, I'm done, kind of thing. I mean, if he didn't, how long would he have been continuing being on the island and shooting? But again, I mean, there are inconsistencies in the story. The police allegedly knew about him. He called many several times. There is this idea that the police couldn't get out there in time, yet afterwards they released data and say, nope, there was no problem. We had the boat and everything was good to go. But the news, you know, the news shopper was there before the police was there. So very, very tricky. Tom, what do you think?
Well, I mean, you're dead right that there is a... certainly the state plays a very strong role in Scandinavia and in Norway in particular from the few Norwegians that I know and, you know, just sort of my general impression of the place. And Breivik kind of highlighted this himself. He was talking in the trial about how he was sort of not only surprised that he got away with all of this and that, you know, he was expecting to just be shot dead by special forces at any moment, but also that talking about the victims on the island itself, how a lot of them didn't actually run away or didn't scream or didn't do anything. They were just sort of paralyzed by fear. They had no way of processing and responding to what was happening to them because it's just completely unexpected. I mean, it's sort of, you know, terrorism doesn't happen very often almost anywhere. There's a few places, like you could say Pakistan has an awful lot of terrorism, Colombia, wherever. Mm. But certainly in Norway, like I say, I think it's in the last sort of 40 years before this massacre, Norway had a grand total of about 14, I think, terrorist attacks, and only one of those was fatal. I mean, you're talking about hardly anything, I mean, compared to, say, in this country, in the UK, we had a, you know, a 40-year war, if you like, in Northern Ireland that spilled over onto the mainland, you know, and throughout the sort of 70s and in the 90s as well. We had regular bombings and regular shootings and kidnappings and all the rest of it. But none of that really existed in Norway. So we're not just looking at the kind of, if you want to call them, I'm trying to sort of find a euphemism, really, for the Norwegian character in that respect. But it's not just down to the state and down to the way that the media responds to the state and all of that. It is also just their common experience is that they were completely unprepared for this. And so when we talk about, you know, the slow nature of the police response in particular in getting out to the island and the whole, you know, farce with this boat that starts taking on water and then has to be abandoned. And yeah, it is quite farcical. But if that happened in Britain or America, I'd be a lot more suspicious of it. I'd be a lot more suspicious of, you know, is this failure deliberate or is it a slowdown or something? Whereas in Norway, they may just not have been prepared for this because they had no real reason to be prepared for something like this to happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, very interesting point. And I heard you guys talk about this. I wanted to get your take on this as well because there is discussion about drills ongoing. Before the event and all this as well. And I just went in again to Aftenposten.no, one of the, you know, Norwegian papers, to confirm the story that we linked up. There was a while ago after the story actually was released on 18th of October, 2011. But this article basically confirmed that the police had made drills going for all the way from 4 days before extending to as close as to about 26 minutes. With a practically identical scenario, and I wanted to get your guys' take on that. Of is that the truth? Was this based on some misinformation or something else? Because as far as I'm concerned, anyway, Aftenposten confirmed that there was police drills taking place, you know, up to 26 minutes before actually the bomb went on in Oslo with that identical scenario. So what is that? And if that's true, then wouldn't they be able to really be on top of this like right away when it actually happens, considering they just did a drill, you know, run through of this scenario?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly an interesting point. I know that Tom's done some research into this because I believe that it had been speculated that there was also a drill on the island as well. Tom, maybe you can discuss.
Well, I mean, what I kind of managed to put together from this is that the story about the exercise in Oslo, the bomb squad exercise at a building or several buildings in that area, right in the middle of, you know, in the middle of Oslo, and certainly near enough that it's very suspicious. That story seems to be true. There was a bomb squad, you know, bombing in buildings exercise running in the 3 or 4 days before the attacks, and that it finished at 3 o'clock in the afternoon of the 22nd of the day of the bombing. And then 26 minutes later, or give or take, supposedly Breivik's bomb blows up. So that is extremely suspicious. And it does speak to why weren't they on top of this. And you, Henrik, in the video presentation that you put together, where you found some of this footage of someone who'd appeared on the scene, not, you know, only a matter of sort of minutes later. Mm-hmm. And it's very strange. It's almost eerie how few people there are there. I mean, this is outside a government building in the middle of a capital city. Why isn't the whole place, you know, swarming with ambulance people and security and all the rest of it?
Right.
That's very odd. But the notion of there being an exercise on the island appears to be a bit of misreporting. It appears to be an old story, also from Aftenposten, saying that there was a sort of shooting rampage drill on the island on the same day, at the same time as this was actually going on. That doesn't seem to have actually happened. That seems to have been a drill that was actually held like 15, 18 months earlier that had sort of somehow got confused with the real drill, the one that did actually happen, mm-hmm. and has sort of, therefore, for rather obvious reasons, been picked up by certain alternative media organs and turned into a, you know, an indication of a bigger conspiracy.
Right, okay. Well, that's an interesting take on that. I'm going to run through the as you said, there is a little bit of difficulty. I mean, just because I'm proximity here to Norway, I don't read the language 100% either. There's some differences and some questions, Mark, I have about the article. But this particular one seems to indicate that it was on the shootings on the island, that's the drill, what that was about, the whole thing, basically. But I'll run through it again. I'll link it up for people so they can, you know, read it themselves and you guys as well. And we can, you know, talk more about that and see where that leads. But you mentioned another very interesting point there as well when it comes to, and this was an apparent inconsistency to me, because Breivik in the trial said that he wanted to, his wish, I guess, was to take out as many people as possible during the bombings, obviously, of the government headquarters. But then he did, and this is a quirk for me at first, at least. I want to get the, you know, your take on this, both of you. He does it in the middle of the summer. July is basically, this is, you know, state-approved holiday season for everybody. The no one is hardly at work during the month of July anywhere in Scandinavia. He also does it at 3 o'clock on a Friday, where obviously people already have been going home earlier from work, etc., meaning there are very, very few people there. Mm-hmm. So the question is, why does he do this if he wants to try to take out as many, you know, people as possible, yet he chooses a time and a date where basically there's no one there? Any thoughts on this, Tom or Britt?
Yeah, I mean, that's true. There was also the parked car outside the government building, which apparently didn't allow him to park his van in the right direction. So, yeah, the building wasn't hit in the way that he wanted it to be hit. I mean, yeah, certainly valid questions there. I mean, in terms of the time of day, I think he actually wanted to detonate the device earlier than he did, but he was caught up sending out his manifesto. Apparently, there'd been big problems with emailing this manifesto to thousands of people, and that had held him up. But in terms of the date, yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure why he didn't choose a date when there were more people there. I mean, of course, he also planned for 3 bombs. That's also come out during the trial.
Yeah.
During the first week, that he'd bought enough fertilizer to try and build 3 bombs, but the process had simply been too difficult for him, and he'd only been able to build one bomb. But what came out also during this recent trial, during the ongoing trial, is the fact that the police actually were under the impression that there were two more bombs just about to go off in Oslo after the first one had detonated. This was the testimony of Tor Langley, who was the police operations leader. And I just think this is interesting that the police thought there were three bombs and Breivik had actually been planning for three bombs. That seems to me, you know, quite a coincidence. And the question has to be, why did they think three? You know, did they have advanced intelligence about Breivik and what he was planning?
Yeah. Tom, anything to add to that?
This story about Breivik wanting to carry out the bombing earlier, that still doesn't really account for why you would do it in the middle of a summer holiday. The whole thing sort of doesn't really add up from the perspective of a terrorist. If your aim is to maximize casualties, then he's built this, you know, I don't know, however many thousands of pounds of explosive that he's put together, sticks it in this Volkswagen truck, drives it into Oslo and you know, sets it off on the fuse and runs away, and manages to kill, I think, eight people. That's I don't want to express it like this, but that's not much of an accomplishment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If from a terrorist point of view, if you're going to do a truck bombing outside a government building, you'd expect to kill 100, 200 people. You'd expect the casualties to be far more than that. And so this does sort of raise the question, was the bombing in Oslo part on and parcel of the same attack as the shootings on the island? That, you know, maybe we're actually looking at two not disconnected events, because obviously they happened on the same day, but two events that may have been carried out for slightly different reasons by different, slightly different people, that you could have a scenario, just for example, speculating here, whereby Breivik didn't plant the bomb in Oslo, but did do the shootings, or possibly the other way around. But the whole thing has been pinned on Breivik because it's the easiest sort of way out of this. It's the easiest story to give to the public that they'll just accept. They'll just hate this individual one man. Half of them will think he's crazy. The other half will think he's some sort of political extremist. And then the whole thing kind of goes away. Hmm. So certainly the questions you're asking, what that triggers in my mind is this question of, are we actually looking at two slightly separate attacks rather than one all being carried out by the same people for the exact same reason?
Right. Well, we have, I mean, again, a similar scenario. we heard that the CCTV cameras footage of the building was, something was wrong with it there in the beginning, but they've released one frame as far as I'm concerned, what I've been able to see. Maybe more has come out since, but there's this one frame of him apparently running away from the government offices in his kind of full, you know, gear, whatever he had on, something that looked like kind of a big helmet, American football type helmet, and with his guns and everything, boots and the police suit and everything, and that to me seems okay. Could there get that indication that it's doctored, not him, another person? Tom, what do you think?
Oh, of course it could be doctored. I mean, the image the image itself is not of great quality, and it doesn't specifically identify Breivik as the person in the image. You know, that could be anyone dressed up like that.
Yeah.
And it does. And the whole kind of story of him running around the middle of Oslo dressed in this sort of commando gear with large guns and everything. Why weren't, you know, people going to the police straight after the bombing and saying, you know, we saw this guy in a big helmet and in combat gear running down the street with a weapon? It just never really kind of made that much sense to me. I think there is a reasonable question and a reasonable suspicion as to whether Breivik was ever actually in Oslo on that day, because so far the evidence that they've presented that he was is basically his own story and his own confession. Outside of that, we have no corroboration of that really at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I want to ask you about this, Britt. What if he then chose this time, because this would be, well, obviously he wanted to target the island, this is when they meet, so he's kind of restricted to the timing here. And also, what if he simply chooses this time because the fewer the people are around, this will be an easier time for him both to park the vehicle there without, you know, arousing too much suspicion of people around. This is the time when he can actually walk out of there with dressed in this gear because there's so few people around because of the timing of the event. Is that a plausible scenario? What do you think, Britt?
Yeah, I mean, also, of course, there were reports of two suspects initially after the bomb had gone off. One of the suspects was believed to be non-Nordic appearance.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting. I mean, I would have to play devil's advocate and say, why would whoever set this up want to minimize the casualties? Why would they care about that?
Yeah, yeah. So that's very interesting. How much weight should we put on this claim of him being part of the Knights Templar? We see him in full Freemasonic garb, the, you know, that he photographed of him, of himself and cropped it out and everything in Photoshop. Has he, you know, revealed the whole story himself with the manifesto and everything and just been honest? But we, most and the majority in the mainstream, don't follow up on it or listen to this. Tom, let's begin with you on that.
Well, one thing it reminds me of is a guy called Ramzi Youssef, who was the 1993 World Trade Center bomber, and among other things, he was a sort of notorious terrorist in the early mid-1990s, caused no end of havoc, killed hundreds of people in various different bombings. And when he was finally kind of brought down, when the FBI finally managed to catch up with him after 2 years of chasing him around Asia, and that's a sort of a bit of a story in itself, one of the things that Youssef tried to persuade the FBI was the case, was that he was part of a larger terrorist group. I mean, and Youssef is quite like Breivik in as much as he is not discernibly insane, but certainly very, like you say, focused or intense. He was a political terrorist. He wasn't particularly religious. He wasn't particularly driven by any kind of Islamist or jihadist notion. It was mainly politics that motivated him to run around blowing things up. And so there is a certain parallel there. And he was trying to convince the FBI that he belonged to a group that he called the Liberation Army, or the Liberation Army 5th Battalion. And this didn't actually exist. This group was not exactly a figment of his imagination, but it was something that he, when he saw a terrorist attack on the news, he would phone up the nearest embassy and claim responsibility for it in the name of the Liberation Army. It was just a sort of tag that he put on something to try and build a more frightening image of him and what he was up to, and to give this impression that there was something kind of bigger behind his actions. So it's always possible that we're seeing the same kind of thing with Breivik, that in fact he may have been not really part of any formal organization. He has all kinds of connections, and I'm sure Britt will outline some of these. But whether that forms into a sort of organization with any kind of hierarchical structure, you know, passing orders down from a leadership to a foot soldier like Breivik,
mm-hmm.
You know, we don't really have anything solid that would suggest he was part of that. What we do have is quite a lot of not incidental, but sort of less firm but certain connections with different organizations like the EDL and what have you. And I'm sure Britt's got something on that as well.
Yeah, I mean, Breivik has actually described his use of uniforms as being deliberately pompous. So I think there's a good chance that he wanted to try and project this image of the network being much bigger than it actually is, as you just talked about, Tom. But I mean, I really think that these people exist who he said that he met in London. He has admitted that he has embellished that meeting, and he's used pompous language to describe it. And this is all part of his marketing campaign. That's what he's described it as, quite extraordinarily. He's used the language of sales to describe his manifesto and these images of him in different uniforms. But yeah, maybe he's not part of a huge network, but as I said before, there's certainly no reason to doubt that he is connected to people. And it's just puzzling to me why that has been dismissed by the authorities.
Uh-huh.
There have been lots of suggestions that he is connected to various organizations. I mean, you did that great interview with Peter Dale Scott and his possible connections to the Arms for Drugs people as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's been talk of connections to the EDL, though he's since denied being in touch with the EDL beyond commenting on a few forums and things like that. But yeah, I mean, it's possible that he is connected to people, and it's possible that those people are being controlled by other people who maybe Breivik doesn't even know himself, you know. He could be, I mean, I really think that he's genuine in his beliefs and what he did is what he meant to do, but that doesn't exclude some kind of higher powers and manipulating that and helping that to happen at all. And we don't have the evidence to prove that at the moment, but this is certainly, as you said at the beginning of the show, a case that's going to be studied for a long time, and I really think it should, because, you know, during the current trial, they're focusing basically on his mental health and on kind of superfluous factors like whether he had a nose job and things like this. And to my mind, the real hard question should be about his connections and whether this is going to happen again. And in the UK, for example, we've had people connected to the EDL, a woman called Roberta Moore, who used to run their Jewish division. And she basically wrote a blog outright stating her support of Breivik. And at the end, she made this veiled threat where she said, there's going to be another Breivik, and next time it's going to be even worse. And a guy called Tommy Robinson, who's the actual leader of the EDL, his real name is Stephen Lennon, he's also gone on television and made these kinds of veiled threats that if the British government doesn't change its policies about immigration, that another Breivik is going to happen. And the way he's saying it, it's not like he's worried about that. He's definitely using that as a tool to try and blackmail people. And yeah, I just wonder why these people aren't being investigated. I mean, as Tom and I have talked about in the past, if a Muslim guy started making comments like this, you can be sure that they would be under surveillance pretty damn quickly. But these kind of you know, right-wing nationalists, they don't seem to be getting too much heat for this, and it's strange to me. And it very much does support this idea of a strategy of tension, because we're seeing this polarization, and it's, you know, it's pretty worrying.
It is. Could it be that they're consciously being left out of the picture? The right people in the right places are saying, no, drop that. That's just a figment of Breivik's imagination. Don't look into these connections, because you will find more people there, but they want this to be left out because they want this ongoing, you know, tension, strategy of tension with domestic terrorism, etc., to be a continuous unfoldment within Western society, because this is the new level of the terrorism. We hear these claims, you know, that what was it that we were going to begin to look at white Al-Qaeda, and isn't this really, in a sense, what this is? Because considering Breivik's comments about how he has been studying Al-Qaeda and then being defined by that, this is just the other side, in my view, of the same coin. And regular people, if you will, out there are now being drawn into a battle between, you know, Christians and Zionists and Muslims out there in the Western world. This is at least the initial process of this, perhaps. Tom, any comments on this?
I think you could very much be onto something there. As Britt said, you know, in the current kind of counter-terrorist climate, it's very strange to see allegations of a wider conspiracy or some kind of wider network being behind this attack just sort of almost be just floating off as though they're not significant, as though none of this is important. I mean, there's several different places we can go with this. Firstly, I would say, if there is a kind of bigger conspiracy or a state conspiracy behind this, I doubt that it was an inside job. I doubt that this was something purely cooked up by the Norwegian government, because I'm not saying they wouldn't do something like that. I'm just saying there doesn't seem to be much kind of indicating in that direction. If there was a bigger conspiracy, it was a bigger conspiracy that went beyond Norway's borders. So Breivik talking about how he sort of almost idolized Al-Qaeda and wanted to create an Al-Qaeda in the West, an Al-Qaeda in Europe, a white Al-Qaeda, as you put it, you know, highly likely that what's down the road, and where this whole war on terror paradigm, this whole milieu that we're living in is headed, is towards more of that sort of scenario. Because part of the problem with blaming Muslims for almost any and every terrorist attack and any and every social problem that you can get away with blaming them for is that the vast majority of them are in the Middle East. So unless we justify a constant you know, invasion, a constant cycle of wars in the Middle East, which we are seeing, I suppose.
Right, yeah.
But, you know, there's only so far you can go with that. In order to kind of domesticate it, in order to then turn that whole paradigm and that whole sense of suspicion and threat, that whole strategy of tension, to turn that back so it's an internal thing, so it can be used as a tool to prevent internal subversions or internal threats to the political order. It has to become more white. It has to become more of a sort of, if not necessarily right-wing nationalist, racist kind of thing, like with Breivik, but maybe also a left-wing extremist, anarchist Occupy movement, sort of that we've already seen that it's heading in that direction a bit. And there's these guys in America who've basically been set up by the FBI, these so-called anarchists, who white guys who've been set up by the FBI to supposedly plan to bomb a bridge. And the whole thing was just a big sting operation. It was just entrapment. It was a complete nonsense. Mm. You were talking about this the other day with those two guys who made a noble lie. Really, really good interview, that one, actually.
Thanks. That was really interesting. And what's interesting about that, as you guys have brought up as well, is the similarities between the Oklahoma City bombing and this case. It's just tremendous, mm-hmm. some of the connections there. So the question is this the same MO? Are we seeing the same strategy being played out? Basically, how to use it and turn it against its own population? Because what I consider to be interesting here with Breivik as well is that he has had if he's genuinely behind this all himself, he has had a plan to target all of EU and maybe even further than that. Everything is done in English. It's not at all just concerned about Norway and Norway's politics. This is about all of Europe and the whole of Europe's attitude towards this. And it's just there's so many components to this case that are very, very interesting. I want to make sure that we don't leave anything behind in that way. But if you guys want to comment on that, or if we should move ahead to some of the other aspects, feel free to do so at this point.
Yeah, I'd just like to say that it's impossible to ignore this trend that we've seen of this kind of unholy alliance of Zionists and far-right nationalists, which is very much part of this whole Breivik terror attack. I'm really not a fan of Zionists or far-right nationalists. I'm not a fan of racism. But what we've seen is, basically a teaming up of these two different factions.
Something you'd never think was possible even 10, 20 years ago?
Exactly,
Now it's happening. It's just amazing. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because that's fascinating.
Yeah, obviously the far right have always been seen as anti-Semitic and, sort of called Nazis, even though a lot of the time I don't think they're actually National Socialist Nazis.
Right.
But they have been, demonized as being anti-Jewish. But now we see this sudden and rather strange support of Israel. We see this very much with the EDL, because at EDL marches they sometimes carry the Star of David flag. As I said before, they have the Jewish division as well, and also the BNP, the British National Party, have come out and voiced their support for Israel. All across Europe we can see this kind of teaming up in the Netherlands as well with Geert Wilders. He's obviously very connected to Israel. I think he's visited the country about 40 times, and it's pretty suspicious, and it's fairly safe to say that he's on Mossad's payroll or on some kind of Israeli payroll. In France recently as well, we even had Jewish people supporting Marine Le Pen, which is completely unprecedented. And how this ties into Breivik, of course, is the fact that in his manifesto he very much makes it clear that he's a Zionist, and there are so many references to his support of Israel and his support of Zionism. And of course it's speculation, but people have talked about the fact that the people on Utoya were actually in favor of Palestine getting its own state, and they were boycotting Israel.
That's right. The day before, I think there was a prominent rally on the island against Israel, advocating boycott, etc. Good point. Continue on that, Britt.
Yeah, it's impossible to name any names or make any firm assertions because there's simply not the evidence. But I certainly do get the impression that there's it's just a sense that there's some kind of race war being fermented, and it's very much the fact that Muslims are becoming the new Jews, which of course is going to benefit Jews and Israel.
Yeah, is this and this is a very, very interesting point, because we see the alignment here, as you talked about, of Breivik to the Zionist state and all that. And what is the deeper significance of this? From one point of view, as far as I've seen it, it's what we're seeing is a ramping up of violence in Europe, where the Europeans are now being, well, basically they're being drawn into a larger conflict that has been raving in the Middle East here now for a long time. And it's almost like they are forced to, I don't know, take sides. Are you left, then you're with the Muslims, or are you on the right wing, then you're with the Israelis, kind of thing. It's very, again, polarized, as the title of your article, Britt.
That's it, yeah. This polarization of society we're seeing, yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Yeah, Tom?
Well, what I was going to say about this is that you're both dead right. You could not have seen this alignment between right-wing nationalism and Zionism. You couldn't have seen it happening in the 1990s, and so it is a particularly strange development in terms of politics, and in particular in terms of kind of fringe politics, which is where what all of this is kind of ultimately about, or at least I think all of this is ultimately about, because the point of a strategy of tension is not necessarily to advance any particular cause or politics. It's not that they're trying to make people be pro-Zionist or anti-Zionist. It is more about kind of redrawing the battle lines, redrawing people's identity with a particular politics, whether that be pro-Zionism or anti-Zionism, perhaps doesn't really matter that much to them. What they want is a fragmented and polarized political discourse whereby everyone is suspicious of each other, everyone is sort of kind of ganging up and having a clan mentality, and, you know, sticking their colors to the mast and saying, this is what I am, and I'm most significantly, I am not what you are, and therefore I am suspicious of you, and therefore the whole thing just becomes more tense and becomes more of a fertile breeding ground for violence, and everyone just sort of becomes more and more scared, and so the security state just has more and more excuse to do what it was always going to do anyway. I don't think this is... I think we can get a bit carried away with the notion that there was somehow... this was a pro-Zionist attack, that somehow Israel was behind this. I don't really see that the Mossad have that much history of this particular sort of terrorism. They certainly run around assassinating significant people. They do that quite a lot. But this is something a bit different. I'm not ruling them out by any means.
Sure.
I'm just saying there is a sort of more subtle approach, I think, that we can take here to say that possibly one of the purposes of these attacks was to cement that newly formed kind of political development, that new kind of branch of the tree that is where nationalism and Zionism are kind of coming into one unit and sort of coming together. And maybe part of the attack was to encourage that, and to encourage that particular kind of that new thing going on in politics as part of this overall map of just, you know, left versus right, nationalist versus internationalist, Muslim versus Jew, the whole thing, just sort of, you know, stirring up that cauldron and stirring up that pot.
Well, Tom, I wanted to ask you about as well, what do you think about, I mean, I was been interested in if these people behind the scenes are creating this strategy of tension that ultimately are benefiting from it. I think you're right in the sense that what if we are trying to categorize them as being left-wing or right-wing, we maybe be losing the plot a little bit. I'm not sure about that yet. But when I looked at this event, the Breivik case, it's almost like I saw a reverse Operation Gladio. My question was, is this really actually a left-wing agenda, a Fabian socialist agenda to get people to associate, you know, understandably all the bad things that Breivik represented, his worldview, etc., to get a more polarization within society and blame it, all of this, then on nationalism, right-wingers, etc.? I mean, anything is possible at this stage, but could there be such a thing as a reverse Operation Gladio, Tom? What do you think?
Of course there could. I mean, that's the whole nature of spying. That's the whole nature of false flag terrorism. You can even have, if you like, false flag terrorism. where you're being suckered into believing that there was someone else behind this, when in fact the person you've been presented with is actually the person who did it, but for a different reason and for a different covert agenda than the one that is being thrown out there. So of course this could be a kind of internationalist, kind of globalist conspiracy that seeks to inflame the right wing and make them look like, or at least the right wing sort of fringe people, the extreme nationalists, make them look uncredible, make them look like a ridiculous and violent and horrible group of people, and therefore use that as a pretext and as an excuse for sort of greater international integration and you know, the advancement of the EU superstate and so on. Always possible, but I think, again, you can get too carried away with that, and because if that was the purpose of this, then it's kind of backfired, because it's not only given a boon and a boost to the left-wingers who are trying to say, oh, the whole of the right wing are just like Breivik, and therefore you can just reject their whole paradigm and all of their concerns and ideas and ideologies. You know, very much the left is using the attack to do that, but at the same time, the right are using this to say, look, there is a very real problem, our concerns are very real, and you can't bloody blame us if we go out and do something like this tomorrow. So if that was the aim, it hasn't worked that well. And that's why I think if there is a wider conspiracy here, it's not about advancing any specific political agenda that we would identify as left, right, socialist, nationalist, whatever. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's about, if it is, it's about advancing the agenda of basically centralized power and ultimately the kind of global security state.
Britt, you drew out this information from, I think it was from the Telegraph. You mentioned one of the statements of Breivik that this was his point, to make conditions, if you will, as far as I understood this, so bad for the right-wingers, if you will then, with his actions, so that they would, if you will, be, you know, like a cornered animal, basically, by the other, you know, left, you know, crowd here, in the sense that they will now also begin to lash out more and more. It's like the noose is being tightened, and the only option they will have left is to continue in the vein of the kinds of actions and events that Breivik did. Tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Breivik specifically said during the second week of the trial that his plan was to provoke a witch hunt of moderate conservative nationalists. And he basically cited an example of Norway's prime minister who'd given a speech shortly after the attacks saying that people who criticized immigration were wrong. He used this as evidence of his plan working. So yeah, he very much wanted to see a crackdown on moderate conservative nationalists, and he believed that this would create more radicalization amongst that group of people, and that they would then turn to the kind of violence that we saw him carry out. I mean, I would question whether that is actually working, because we do see a rise of the right throughout Europe. You know, in various countries, Hungary, Geert Wilders' party, the Freedom Party in the Netherlands, is also doing pretty well.
The Greek elections, you've just had these sort of so-called neo-Nazis appear for the first time in the Greek elections in a big way. It's happening all over Europe.
Sorry to interrupt that, bit, but could this be the point a little bit to... this might be a stretch then, but to create conditions in Europe that are, to a certain extent, bad. I want to tie into this the conversation that you guys had about how Sarkozy, Merkel, was it David Cameron as well, talked about multiculturalism, the fact that it had failed, kind of dropping the ball on that, just indicating to people, yep, the conditions are really bad. All right, let's move on to something else. I mean, you can't do that. I mean, that's horrendous. I mean, that is going to create more problems. It's going to instigate, yep, there is something wrong here. But if you don't follow up on that conversation and try to talk about it, this is a pressure cooker that's going to build up. So again, I'm back to that idea. Well, is that the point then?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, what you're referring to here is Merkel and Sarkozy and David Cameron, when they outright stated that they thought multiculturalism was dead. I can't remember which one of those said it first, but then very shortly afterwards, I think it was Cameron and Sarkozy at the same time, both said exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
And it just struck me as such a strange thing to say. And I really did think at that point that this has to be part of some agenda, because, you know, politicians don't simply say something like that. I mean, it had to be planned. There had to be a reason for it. And especially three European leaders saying that the exact same thing at not too distant times.
It's not a coincidence, is it?
No, it's not. No, and it very much did make me think that, yes, our very leaders, the people on display, are even part of this agenda to destabilize Europe and to just foment this kind of war that's happening. And it's pretty disturbing, really. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I just want to say, so Breivik, in all of this, conveniently, in a way, then comes along at the right time here and does this, or someone is behind him. Someone is allowing him to do it. Someone is planning it and setting it up. What should we make? I guess I can ask you about this first, Britt, the so-called mentor in London and how much influence this has. And again, the Norwegian authorities and police have worked in unison with the British police or you know, the secret services over there on this question. But I mean, if it says it, this is things that they should follow up on, I guess, but I'm not sure if they have. Do you know that, the mentor here?
I mean, there's a whole story to this, because basically his mentor he named as a guy called Richard the Lionhearted, and there's a guy called Paul Ray, who was one of the founders of the EDL, who's since had to leave England. He was being chased by the police for something, and he actually moved to Malta because he's basically a Knights Templar member. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he blogs under the name of Lionheart, and I think he actually had to travel to Norway to be interviewed by the police, because they thought that he was Breivik's mentor. Now, this guy, you know, was obviously horrified by this. He's written quite an extensive blog where he's expressed his, you know, horror at being labeled as Breivik's mentor. He's totally disassociated himself from what Breivik did. And, I mean, he's come out with he's outright accused the sort of shadowy mastermind of the English Defence League, who's a guy called Alan Lake, whose real name is Alan Ayling. This is a very rich businessman who's basically a funder of the EDL. And yeah, Paul Ray is basically pointing the finger at Alan Lake as being Breivik's mentor. Now, I've contacted Paul Ray, and he was kind of not very forthcoming with any kind of evidence, which did lead me to suspect he's holding some kind of grudge, because he fell out with the EDL, with the founding members of the EDL. But yeah, I mean, I don't know who is Richard the Lionhearted, but you know, they need to find this guy. This is the guy that apparently gave Breivik the brief to write his manifesto. So, you know, he's a key player in all this. And as I've said before, there could be, well, people above him, you know, that we don't know about. So, no, they seem to have dropped Richard the Lionhearted. He seems to have been forgotten about now. And, yeah, we're simply focusing on details about whether Breivik wore makeup and things like this, when, you know, there's far more important things that should be investigated thoroughly.
Yeah. It's a good point. It hasn't really been open the trial. Some of the things were censored. I remember that right away. I understand it's difficult for people to let, you know, Breivik have a platform by this atrocity. I understand that point, but at the same time, it's very difficult. But wouldn't you also want to hear the guy out, see what he has to say about it? I remember the trial with the statements that was, I think, censored by the media, and they didn't, put the video feed of this out there. And there's been another couple of cases where this has happened as well, at least the feeds I've been watching, that they've chosen certain media outlets not to, you know, proceed and show this, basically. So it's kind of bad in that way. But it's this case is interesting for the fact that it seems also that everyone is projecting, if you will, what they have found onto Breivik, of what he represents. It's like one of these kind of one-size-fits-all kind of terrorists. And one seems to be able to find whatever connection one wants and put those on him. It's very, again, I just want to, you know, send this, or, you know, put out this idea that could he still Tom, we could begin with you on this. Is it still that he could actually act 100% alone on this thing, and he's just 100% genuine? He pulled it off himself. If so, is it? I mean, it is a remarkable feat, but it's still within the realm of possibility. Is it? Is it not?
I think it is still within the realm of possibility. Just about. I mean, it's the bombing. To be honest, building a truck bomb isn't tremendously difficult. It is difficult, but it, you know, Breivik was clearly a relatively well-educated, relatively smart guy, so it's possible he could have done that. The shootings on the island, people have pointed out that, you know, if this was a lone spree killing, a single shooter spree killing, then it would be by some distance the sort of most lethal and most brutal spree killing in recent history. So, yeah. There is that question hanging over it. Could he have killed that many people in that amount of time with those weapons? Maybe he could, maybe he couldn't. but particularly, they were on a small island without much place to escape. It's not like sort of carrying out a shooting spree at a shopping center where there's lots of different places for people to hide and run off to and so on. They were kind of isolated in that respect. So maybe that leans more towards the it was possible that this was one man. But again, even if it was only one man, that would still leave open the question of, you know, did anyone else help him prior to the attacks?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did anyone let him do this? Did they have any informant close to him who told them about this and they, you know, decided to let it slip by for whatever reason, whether by accident or by design? You know, even if it was a one man actually physically carrying out the attacks, that still doesn't close the door to the question of a wider conspiracy and a wider agenda being at play in these attacks.
Britt, any final comments on that? I want to take a little break here in a minute and mention both of you guys' websites and give up some other information about how people can follow your work and so forth. But before that, though, any final comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, initially I thought it quite unbelievable that he could have done this by himself, but having sort of monitored the trial, he does seem, you know, just incredibly focused. And yeah, I think it is quite possible that he carried out the bombing and the shootings by himself. But yeah, I mean, there are all sorts of questions about the help that he got to plan it. And also, of course, you know, how he wasn't stopped before carrying out the attack, because the PST, the Norwegian intelligence services, I mean, he was on their radar after having bought some chemicals in Poland. And, you know, it's not only that, it's the fact that he was quite prolific on the internet, on different blogs. Apparently, you know, he was quite restrained in what he did on the blogs because he knew that he could well be monitored. But also he was traveling all around Europe. I think he visited like 24 countries. He was purchasing all kinds of arms and weaponry as well. He was a member of a gun club. And, you know, amongst his friends, he was quite sort of vocally anti-Muslim. So all of these things together, I mean, it's strange to me how he wasn't stopped, you know, how they didn't pick up on that.
I agree, totally agree. Britt, your website, resistradio.com, is where people can listen to you and follow you more regularly. What do you want to tell our listeners about your work, your writing and your radio programs, Britt?
Yeah, I just would like to encourage people to check out resistradio.com. I write regular articles about exactly this kind of topic, terrorism and contrived terrorism. And I also do regular podcasts on those topics as well. So, yeah, check out resistradio.com.
Really good. And then, Tom Secker, you also have a program on resistradio.com, but you also run the website investigatingtheterror.com. As far as I understand, you look into quite a bit of detail on both 7/7, 9/11, and obviously all kinds of terror events, which partially led you to the Breivik case here, I guess, as well. Then.
Yeah. I mean, that's my website. You can find, I've made two feature-length documentaries on 7/7. That's sort of how I got into all of this, or at least one of the main reasons I got into all of this in the first place. You can find both of the films are on my website and they're freely available online. You know, I'm not in any way charging for this, so please go and watch them. And you can also find previous interviews I've done and discussion shows. We're now doing a sort of regular discussion show with Resist Radio, me and Britt, just sort of going over news related to terrorism and the security services and spies and all sorts of interesting stuff. and also an awful lot of my source material. I try and make as much of my source material from Freedom of Information requests and archive searches and things. I try to upload as much of that to my website as well. So yeah, investigatingtheterror.com, it's got pretty much all my work on it.
Really good. Have a look, guys. Resistradio.com, investigatingtheterror.com as well. All right, stay with us here. We'll take a short break at this point. We'll be back with more after this. We continue in the second hour to discuss the Breivik case and trial with Britt and Tom. We begin discussing how Anders Breivik was put on the Norwegian intelligence watch list after buying chemicals online. We discuss security at the price of no privacy. Then we talk about Anders' manifesto, his declarations, and his sanity. Dee and Secker bring up his fascination and study of the Al-Qaeda. We explore the possibility of Breivik as a mind-controlled patsy. Later, we mention oddities surrounding this case, including witness reports of hearing foreign voices on Utøya Island during the shootings, and we also discuss Breivik's mother. Lastly, we touch upon multiculturalism as a failed experiment and the possible political and social outcomes because of this case. We have much more for you in our member section, not only this second hour with Britt and Tom, but also all our programs going back to 2006. Research, opinion, thoughts, and perspective-widening material on so many different topics, all that we find interesting and important. With a membership, you can also watch all of our TV programs, webcasts, films, and videos. We also have music and behind-the-scenes audio commentary available. It's only €5 per month, and this is how we stay advertisement-free. So sign up if you're not yet a member. You'll get instant access and can stay with us here for the full program. So sign up for a membership at redeyescreations.com. Next on Red Ice Radio, you'll be able to hear Nora Gedgaudas on the paleo diet and the detrimental effects of farming. Petur Haldursson from Iceland on his book The Measure of the Cosmos. Then we have Richard Grove, Winter Lake, Alex Newman, Eric Karlström, Less Visible, Nils Axel Mörner, Freeman will return as well, Denise Barcelo, Drunbull Melchizedek, Jordan Maxwell, and many more. Some great programs coming up for you. Also, don't miss Radio 314, our new program on the Red Ice Radio Network. Past guests include Elaine Niakuna and Johnny Enoch. Upcoming guests, Tom Montauk. Don't miss it. But we'll be right back, right here, right now, with Britt D. and Tom Secker. Stay with us for more.